Meditation has been underestimated in the West to such a degree that it appears to be something new. It's as old as mankind, and it's our technological age that has made it appear something strange, Eastern, esoteric. It's nothing of the kind. We have records of meditation instructions and meditation practice that go back 5,000 years in the Rig Vedas, in the Hindu Brahminical tradition in which the Buddha grew up. When he grew up in it, he actually, as tradition tells us, that he spontaneously, as a child of 12, started meditating without having had instructions. This isn't as unusual as it may sound. Talking to grown-ups about meditation for many years now and listening to their stories, it is amazing how many people have done it as children spontaneously without ever knowing that it was meditation. Naturally, nobody told them, and they usually, the child never mentioned it either. It's a far more common an experience than one would think. The Buddha grew up in this Hindu Brahminical tradition in which meditation was an established fact and an established tradition. He gave it an innovation. Actually, he was like a reformer, and specifically on two points, and this is one point. The other point was the belief that some outside force would do something for one if one didn't do it inside. But in the specifically in the meditation practice, what was known in his tradition, and is still known today, of course, and he also taught it over and over again, are what we call the meditative absorptions, in Pali the jhanas, and they are 8 in number. And as he went away from his palace, in order to find the way out of all grief, pain, and lamentation, he went to two meditation teachers. The first one taught him what are called the arupa jhanas, the rupa jhanas, which are the fine material meditative absorptions. It's such a long word in English. And the second one taught him the arupa jhanas, the non-material meditative absorptions. The first teacher thought that what he taught was all there was to it, that was all there was to the spiritual path, that now since the Buddha, who was then still Prince Siddhartha Gautama, was now as completely competent in being a teacher himself. But the Buddha knew, no, that wasn't all there was to it. There had to be more. So he found another teacher, and he taught him the second four steps. And again, the teacher thought, now, this is all. This person is now completely competent as a teacher. In fact, he does it better than I can do it. And wanted to turn over all his pupils and his whole establishment to then Prince Siddhartha Gautama. But this is where the Buddha's intuitive wisdom stopped him from accepting this rather prestigious and also favorable offer, because that teacher was well thought of and considered to be of the highest attainment in the spiritual life. The Buddha said, no, this is not what I have been looking for. There's more. Of course, the teacher thought that was nonsense, but there was nothing he could do. He had to let him go. And since there was no teacher available to teach any more, the Buddha, who was not the Buddha yet, because the Buddha means the enlightened one, had to strike out on his own, which he did, as tradition tells us, in the today Bodh Gaya, under the Bodhi tree. And what happened was this, and this is important to know, because if we don't know exactly how the Buddha did it, it stands to reason that we're not going to do it either. But since it is humanly possible, there's no reason why we can't do it. He went through the eight absorptions, the meditative absorptions, and came out of them again. And with the mind in a completely calm, expanded, and pliable state, without any thought, totally at ease and at peace, he could see within himself, with his own inner vision, what was the cause for all our human problems. And because he was of a mental genius, he was able to formulate it and verbalize it in a very succinct, simple, and short form, which is available to us today, the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, which state that existence is suffering, that there's only one cause for suffering, which is craving, that there is an end to suffering, which is called Nibbana, and that there is an eightfold step, to take eight steps which lead one to the end of suffering. That formulation was done when he came out of his meditative state and saw that he was able to let go of all the things that would cause suffering. This formulation was the addition, the new thing that was added to the meditative path, and it's called insight, vipassana or panya. Vipassana is the Pali word for insight, panya is the Pali word for wisdom. That what preceded it is samatha or samadhi, calm. Calm and tranquility. And it is the last step on the Noble Eightfold Path. Sama Samadhi, right concentration. And it has to mean the eight absorptions. It cannot mean anything else. Everything else is conjecture and wishful thinking. It has to be meditative absorptions. In other words, the Buddha taught, as all teachers do, exactly what he himself did. And this is how he did it. There are later teachers who deny this, that this is a necessary way, that it's too difficult, that it can't be done. It's a mistaken view. It's an utterly mistaken view, unfortunately, because it's not too difficult. It's being done all over the world by people everywhere. It has to have three foundations. This meditative path has to have three foundations, which have to be gained in daily life. These three foundations are metta, sila, and dana. Metta, I talked about it yesterday. Unconditional love, the kind of loving heart that loves because it has educated itself to do just that. In other words, it has very little hate, very little dislike. None is too much. That is an end product. But little. And as soon as it has some, it realizes that's not the way to go. Now, this unconditional love and this little dislike does not only concern people. As of course, this is where we have our most difficulties, liking and loving people. But it concerns all sorts of things which put a little bit of a negativity into the mind. It has to do with our daily activities, where we don't like our job, where we don't like waiting for the bus, where we don't like the weather, where we don't like the food, all sorts of things that we don't like. All of that we can work on. We don't have to be perfect to start meditating, but we have to work on two levels. We have to work on the level of purification in daily life, and we have to work on the level of meditating in order to support that purification, and also the purification to support the meditation. They have to work together. One at a time is not enough. They need mutual support. Sila is moral conduct according to the five precepts of the Buddha, who are the minimum behavior training that guarantee a harmonious and fairly easy living. And it means not killing, not stealing, being faithful, right kind of speech, and no alcohol and drugs, obviously, because alcohol and drugs confuse the mind even more than it is already confused. And you can see from that the same problem existed 2,500 years ago. Maybe not to the extent it exists today, but it certainly existed, because if it didn't, there was no need to say anything about it. Humanity has always had the same problems, but it also has the same capacities. What the people in India did 5,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, was done with the human mind, namely the 8 meditative absorptions, and we've got the same human mind. All we have to do is put our mind on it. That's all. Keep it there. So this is the second support. And the third support is dana, generosity, which means that we know that others are important, that it is to our own benefit if we think of them, that if we give to them, whatever it is that we have to give, doesn't have to be necessarily material, although that too is, of course, a generosity, time, love, attention, listening, care, whatever it is we can give. It makes us less rigid. It makes us pliable. It makes us movable and expandable. Rigidity in the mind is not conducive to meditation. It has to be a pliable mind. It has to be soft. It has to be able to change itself from its usual pattern. So these three are supports. These are the support systems that we need in daily life. When we have these support systems and also want to meditate, we have to understand, first of all, that there are innumerable methods, and a method is a method by any name. It's not the meditation. Now, that is so important that I usually repeat the sentence, because people think the method is the meditation. Whether you watch the breath at the nostrils or at the rise and fall of the stomach has been a subject of violent debate and great animosity. And it doesn't make the slightest difference. It just absolutely makes no difference at all. And there has been such animosity about it, it's really ridiculous. Whether we watch, even if we can become concentrated by watching a flame on a candle, not that I'm advocating that, but it is also done, or whether we watch a color disc, or whatever it is that we're watching, it's a key. That's all it is. Method is key. Now, we have to be able to hold that key firmly in hand without wavering and shaking about in order to stick it into the keyhole. Once we've stuck it into the keyhole and unlocked the door, that's when we start meditating. Method is method by any name. It makes no difference. The traditional method that is used mostly, not even only in the Buddhist tradition, but particularly in the Buddhist tradition, certainly also in the Hindu tradition, is the breath. The breath, because, for one thing, it is something that we always have. We can't forget it at home. We go to a meditation course, maybe we forgot something at home, and we can't do that with the breath. You've got to bring it along. It is also life. Without breath, no life. So it gives us a very clear indication what our life is like. Totally impermanent, constantly changing. If that breath didn't do that, we'd be dead. Life is a constant process of changing phenomena all the time. So that's our first introduction when we start with the breath, to see it can't remain static. It's got to move. That is, in the beginning, something that the mind would like to forget about. We are looking for solidity, security, permanence, continuity. We can't have it. So many people that realize it can't be had, then use other ways of escape. There is no escape. Whether even we want to escape through any medium, there are many mediums that are used for escape, it's impossible. Whether we agree to the impermanence, to the constant changing phenomena, or disagree with it, it makes absolutely no difference. It's always the same. It's always changing, in and out. So using the breath is one method. And traditionally, in most cases, taught to be watched at the nostrils. As it is only a key, it has to be held steady. Now, the difficulty that arises from holding it steady is naturally the thinking. Anybody who's ever tried meditating knows that all the thing that's happened is thinking. Thinking, 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 thinking. Why? Why can't the mind stay where it is supposed to stay? If one really wants to meditate, why doesn't it stay there? I mean, I really want to, and then the mind starts thinking. Well, the reason for that is our ego. We even have a philosophy that says so. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. It's all nonsense. I am, therefore I think. It's the other way around. But the only ego support we can get is when we're thinking. As soon as we stop thinking, the ego objects. The first thing that happens in most people's case is a slight touch of fear. And immediately the mind says, oh, what was that? The ego talking. The ego does not want to be even momentarily eliminated, not even for a minute or two. It just wants to go on thinking, thinking, as we have always done. This is the pattern we're used to. We're used to thinking. The mind thinks all day and dreams all night, even if we don't remember our dreams. We know that we do. Now, the mind is the one tool in the universe that has made it all happen, particularly ourselves, but everything else. It is a tool that has the seed of enlightenment in it. It is the one jewel that we have. Everything else is completely dependent upon outer circumstances. This one we've got. But we treat it as if it was dead. We take it for granted. We don't do anything for it. We have no interest in its development. We don't look after it and polish it and clean it up like any jewel that we would own, that we want to wear on our fingers maybe, it would be cleaned and polished. We don't do anything for it. We just take it for granted. I think, therefore I am. And it has been so ingrained in our psyche that it takes a fair bit of pushing and pulling to get out of this kind of thought process. The mind is the jewel that we have, which can bring us to the end of all problems. It is the only thing that can bring us to the end of all problems. It doesn't mean that we have to remove every obstacle outside of us. It means we remove every obstacle inside of us, but it's only the mind that can do it. So in having such a mind, it means that we have overworked it. We've been thinking ever since we came around this time and dreaming naturally too. Now, if we had such a fine instrument that we had bought at a great expense in some shop, I'm sure we wouldn't let it run all the time. When this little tape recorder stuck into the wall there has been running for 45 minutes, that little plug there is absolutely hot after 45 minutes. Can you imagine what goes on in the mind? That's been going since after we were born. It's been running hot all the time. And not only that, it's never got any oil, never got a moment's rest, never got a cleanup. So how can we expect it to run in a good way? It's just doing its bare minimum, enough to survive in a competitive world. And where there is no competition, we give up anyway. We know all the systems without competition, everybody gives up. As long as there's competition, we've got to, because our survival instinct is the strongest. But that's all our mind does. It works for our survival. Now that's a futile exercise. None of us are going to survive. Guaranteed. I'll give you a written guarantee if you like. It's a totally futile exercise to use this mind for survival. This is a bare minimum. It's a fundamental necessity, because we can't do anything else if we don't survive. But that's not what this mind is for. It's not for survival. So having used it in that way, where it hasn't got any rest at all, naturally it hasn't got any new energy. And so we find very often older people losing their memories, senility, and even not so old people having difficulties with learning something new. The mind just hasn't got the energy input that it needs, because it has never got a rest. The first thing that the mind needs is a rest, a cleanup, and some exercise to give it some muscles. It's the only way we can do that is through meditation. The first moment that we are concentrated, for just 1 minute or 1 second, we have 1 second of purification, 1 second of a cleanup. Because when, although we can have so many mind moments in a flash, but 1 second of concentration is 1 second of purification, because we cannot have two things in the mind at once, luckily. So if we're actually concentrated on our meditation subject, let's say the breath, then that moment is a moment of purification. And at the same time, it also gives us the first inkling, if we haven't done it before, that it's possible not to think and still stay alive. It isn't necessary to think all the time. And if it lasts a little longer than 1 second, maybe let's say it lasts even 5 minutes, which is possible, we can even get an inkling what it means to get a little bit of peace. And it's our first introduction to what peace really means. peace means not thinking. But the opposite of not thinking is not being a vegetable. The opposite of not thinking, the actual activity of not thinking, is experiencing. And when we experience what goes on without thinking about it, we're getting in touch with reality. The first time we're in touch with reality, except for some spontaneous moments that do happen to people quite frequently. Let's say they're standing at the ocean and they're watching the waves and there's a beautiful sunrise. And all of a sudden, the whole attention is focused on that sunrise and there is not a thought in the mind saying, oh, what a beautiful sunrise, that comes after. That focusing of attention is a spontaneous experiencing. And then people usually think, oh, they want to get back to some sunrise because that makes them happy. It's not the sunrise that makes them happy. It's the sunrise that was the trigger that kept the attention going. We can have that any moment, anywhere, if we train ourselves, our minds, properly. We don't have to run up to the ocean and find the sunrise, which might not even happen because it's all gray. But the sunrise in the heart can happen. So what we are doing when we're not thinking is not that we're becoming some sort of robot or moron or something like that, which is also a mistaken idea that people sometimes get, especially those that don't want to meditate, it's too much trouble. But it is a lesson in experiencing. And there we get in touch with what really is, instead of that what we're thinking about. Life cannot be thought about. It doesn't work that way. Life is being experienced. And most of the time, the experiencing only starts when there's a heavy input. Either a heavy input of something that we really like or that we really dislike. The other times, we're sort of coasting along. Not necessary and also a waste of time. Now, if we keep our attention focused on this meditation subject for a little while, we have, first of all, the purification, which comes from not having any negativity in the mind. Secondly, the understanding that thinking doesn't give us reality. It's the experiencing. We use the simile, the old and tried simile of biting into the mango. You can tell somebody 100 times what a mango tastes like, that it is very sweet, very juicy, very soft, very delicious. But if you haven't bitten into a mango, you haven't got a clue what it tastes like. You've got to bite into it. That's the difference between thinking about something, explaining it, and experiencing it. The experience of it makes all the difference. So we have that understanding, we get that. And also, we're getting some muscles into the mind. We're getting some power into the mind. The mind is, most people's mind is pretty powerless. It's being pushed around by outer circumstances. Somebody says something nice, everything's all right. Somebody says something awful, everything is terrible. The mind is being pushed around by its likes and dislikes. And it cannot even rely on its own reactions. So there is no power behind the mind, nothing that we can actually use in order to get nearer to reality within ourselves, because the whole reality lies within us. So the muscles which we develop through staying on the subject give the mind a little more power, which we then use again to continue with the meditation. Now, meditation is something that needs to be done every day. Not once in a great while, not just when some teacher comes around, when somebody offers some meditation retreat or whatever it may be. It's certainly useless to read about, and it's almost as useless to talk about. The only thing to do is to do it. But in order to do it properly, one needs guidance. Meditation without guidance doesn't get one very far, because it is sort of a no man's land. It's a no man's land because we're totally unacquainted with our own mind. We're constantly being surprised by our reactions. And after a while, we're not even surprised anymore. We just expect all these things. Happiness, unhappiness, frustration, boredom, dislikes. It's just happening. So it must be the world we live in. It must be the atomic bomb or something. It must be something. It's nothing. It's the mind that does it all. The constant mind reaction. But since we are not aware of these things, we do need a bit of guidance in the beginning. And preferably all the way. If we are able to keep our attention on the meditation subject for some time, it is, as I said, the key to unlock the door. Now, the door leads, we could say, as a symbolism, into a house with 8 rooms. The first thing that we experience is the entrance hall, naturally. And in that entrance hall, the door is wide open. We can naturally throw the key away. We don't need the method anymore. This is one of the unfortunate things that are happening in the world today, because we are time-wise so far removed from the Buddha's time that when people actually do open the door and get in there and could start meditating, they are advised to go back to the breath. In other words, to grab the key again, although the door is already open. And this happens today all over the world because of the fact that we are without the, first of all in the West, without the tradition of meditation and without the necessary know-how. In India, the tradition of meditation has of course also declined tremendously, but it is still based on a continuity from 5,000 years, which we don't have. So what we need is we need a bridge. It's not that our minds don't do it just as well as theirs. It's just that we're lacking the input. The information isn't there. We haven't got the old books to look it up in. We haven't got the old teachers to tell us. That's all. Our minds can do it easily as well. Absolutely no difference. I do teach East and West. There's no difference in the minds. So once having entered this house in the entrance hall and having thrown the key away, we need a new focus for our attention. And the first focus for our attention at that time are the feelings. What happens at the time when the meditation has come to the point of being able to open the door is that if we're using the breath becomes very fine. It's difficult to find. And it has become so fine because the mind has become fine. And this is why the breath is such a preferred meditation subject. It is intrinsically connected to the mind. If we are excited or in a hurry, our breath goes fast. If we're very calm and at ease, the breath follows suit. So at the time when the mind has become very calm, then the breath becomes very, very fine and at times hard to find. This is when we revert to feeling. Now, there are, as I said earlier, 8 steps of meditative absorptions. But I think that at this point in time, it might be premature to talk about anything more than the opening of the door and unlocking it and getting in there. The I will say so, though, the intention and results of these meditative absorptions, I won't explain them exactly because I don't think that it would be useful. But what happens is this, that as a mind can become absorbed and experience what is going on inside of oneself, one comes to a feeling of such joy and peacefulness and contentment that the immediate understanding after the meditation is that this is the kind of joy, peace, and contentment that is unavailable in the world. Although we are familiar with joy and peaceful feeling and contentment, and therefore these absorptions are called the fine material absorptions because they have to do with our materiality of body and mind, they are so much finer that they are so much more also. They are qualitatively so much in excess of what we know that they are also quantitatively so much in excess. In other words, having done that, the lures and temptations of the material world lose all their glitter. We realize them to be fool's gold. Fool's gold is the kind of mineral that a gold digger finds, thinking it's gold, taking it to the assayer, and finding out it's nothing but a glittering metal. It is always it's always to be found wherever gold is found. Wherever gold is found in the ground, there is also fool's gold to be found. So it is the same with us. We have that within which would bring us total happiness, total peacefulness, total contentment. But we have so much fool's gold out there in all the shop windows and within our own instincts that we're constantly running after that, thinking, that's it. If it wasn't the one before, it must be the next one. And if it isn't that one, we'll find a new one. And there are so many new ones because we're always inventing new ones. We're constantly inventing a new thing of this and a new thing of that, so that we always have to run after a new one. But having experienced it, not heard about it, but experienced it, there's no question anymore. Having bitten into the mango, one knows what a mango tastes like. And that taste is far superior to any taste that we've had before. And therefore, there is also a danger. Instead of being attached to the material world and trying to get as much out of it as one can, one now gets attached to the meditative world, trying to get as much out of it as one can. Doesn't work either. The spiritual path has only one facet. The rest is all instruction and information. The one inner facet is the letting go. That's all there is to it. Letting go, letting go, letting go. Without letting go, there's no spirituality, there's no spiritual growth. So what happens when the mind is able to become absorbed into its inner being is that when the meditation is at an end, we must see the impermanence of even those nice states. Now we are perfectly happy to realize impermanence of all our pain, grief, and lamentation. Nobody objects to the impermanence of that. We have a pain in the back, and it's impermanent, wonderful. Somebody is nasty, and that's impermanent, wonderful. But now we're happy, and that too is impermanent. It's got to be. The minute we open our eyes, the whole thing is gone. So then, that time, the mind has not been thinking but experiencing, and therefore it can experience impermanence at a much deeper level. Now, I'm sure I could ask anyone on the street, anywhere, whether everything's impermanent. And they'd probably say, oh, yeah, everything's impermanent. That's right, yes, everything's impermanent. And they just walk on and finished. No thought about it any further. But at the end of a meditative experience, when the mind sees this happiness, joy, or peacefulness slipping away and being no longer available at that time, a deep impression is made on the mind of the complete lack of solidity of this person that we're always trying to support to the extent where it becomes more and more solid. And we are getting a little of a shake of this solidity and security syndrome that we are working on, which doesn't ever have any success. That is the first one thing that we realize. But we also realize that having been able to gain this within oneself, that there must be more. It is a natural human phenomena not to be totally satisfied until there is an absolute understanding of no more to come. So as we practice this meditation and are able to gain states of joy, contentment and peacefulness, the mind has become very luminous and it has become very pliable and it has become soft in its nature, no rigidity. It doesn't have its own thought patterns so ingrained anymore. The rigidity of the absolute viewpoint that we have, well, we all have absolute viewpoints on everything, from food to sex to money to the world and people. All these vanish completely during the meditation time, mind you. They all come back, of course. But at the meditation time, all this is gone. So we have a totally different quality of mind, which goes to an expansion of a changed consciousness. The changed consciousness which arises is a consciousness, a universal consciousness. Because the mind is able to expand to the extent where the personality and identity that we live with and work with all the time is no longer apparent at that time. What is apparent instead is universality. Universality of physical phenomena, space, and universality of mental phenomena, consciousness. That gives a very direct experience of the fallacy of thinking that each one of us is a separate individual. I like to express this as that it gives an experience of a vast ocean in which little bubbles come up. And this one little bubble says, I'm much bigger than you. And the next little bubble says, I'm much cleverer. And the third one says, and I'm much prettier. And the fourth one says, oh, I'm so small. Can't you help me? And these are all the different people. They've just, and one realizes that there's nothing to differentiate between them, that they're all one huge ocean that this has come from. This is a universality experience and totality experience, which then arouses in the person who has it an understanding that nobody is different from the next, and the kind of compassion and lovingness that one can extend towards others is like extending it towards oneself. There's no limit, no limitation in between each person. It makes life much easier. It certainly isn't enlightenment, but it makes life much easier. And another experience which happens, and these are the non-material absorptions, is the experience that within the whole universe, as far and wide as consciousness can reach, there is nothing solid to hang on to. Now, in the meditation, that is a perfectly acceptable and very freeing experience. In an intellectual way, it is frightening. We don't want to know about it. I've got to have something to hang on to, at least my bank account or my insurance policy or my family or my body or something. Something, whatever it may be. But in reality, as we are able to expand the mind, this freeing off, hanging on to things which are obviously also impermanent, is let go of because we can see there's nothing there. And it accords with what our scientists have been saying for the last 12 or 15 years when they made the experiments in the bubble chamber in America. They have a laboratory they call the bubble chamber. I don't know why it's called the bubble chamber. And the experiments that they made was that they found, without a shadow of a doubt, that there wasn't a single solid building block in the whole of the universe. That everything are energy particles that come together and fall apart at such speed that they give the appearance of solidity. Now, if those scientists who did that had included themselves in that experiment, they would have been enlightened. This way, they're just very good scientists. The Buddha said exactly the same thing without a bubble chamber because he experienced it in his meditation. We can experience it too. It's easier than one should think because up to now, there has been, for some reason or other, I don't quite know why, great secrecy and lack of information about the meditative absorptions and a sort of thought, a process that they are too difficult for people today to do because people today are in such stress and speed situations that they could not possibly concentrate their minds to the point of becoming absorbed. Well, I will say this, it is difficult to become a master of the absorptions. One needs time and effort for that. But to get near and to have glimpses of these states is done everywhere. And many people, interestingly enough, have done it spontaneously. If they've meditated, they've had experiences like that. Of course, not knowing what it is, they didn't continue it. And finally, finding out what it is, they're able to continue it and use it as a legitimate experience. In fact, there are people who come to one of these states without even meditating. And of course, it's frightening. What happens is that the mind successively purifies and successively becomes more and more subtle. But if we touch upon them accidentally, they can be a little frightening. And people do touch upon them accidentally in times of great stress sometimes, when there's a great deal of pain or grief, it can happen. It can also happen in times of great joy, but it is very rare, of course. But for meditators, it's not rare at all that to touch upon those states and then find no way of continuing it. There are ways and means, of course, of getting instructions how to be able to continue with that. The first step, of course, one has to do oneself. What happens to the mind is this. It becomes a different medium. The ordinary mind that goes shopping, goes to the office, cleans house, telephones, reads newspapers, and attends to the television, that mind we all know. A very ordinary mind, everybody knows it. It is not exactly the kind of tool that is geared towards a greater and more sublime states. But we are aware of changes of consciousness. We are aware of more sublime mind states in times of loving somebody very deeply. We feel different. Maybe having gone to a beautiful cathedral somewhere as a tourist and feeling the atmosphere of devotion and having a different kind of consciousness. Maybe having been in a place of where people were very worshipful and loving and feeling a different kind of consciousness. All these things have been happening in people's lives momentarily. And many people would actually have the understanding that they would like to have a kind of consciousness which does surpass this ordinary pedestrian kind that we live with. The pedestrian kind is necessary in order to do the pedestrian things. But if our consciousness is far more universal and sublime and elevated, the pedestrian things can be done anyway. It's not that we can't go shopping anymore if we can get into the meditative absorptions. One can do the lower if one has gone higher, but one can't do the higher if one stays on the low step. So the consciousness which arises out of those meditative states, although we can't keep the peacefulness and the happiness within to the same degree that we fed them in the meditation, yet the mind states which arise out of them for our daily life are still changed. They are still a different kind of consciousness within. First of all, we have the assurance that we can get back to it. With the right kind of guidance, we can get back to it. So we know that no matter how much stress, how much frustration, how much worry, it's not necessary to be involved with it. We can get back to our own peace and happiness. We've done it before, we can do it again. It is the same as knowing we have a warm house to go to when the snow is falling. If we didn't know we could get back inside with where the body can feel comfortable again, but we'd have to live outside in the snow, we'd feel rather worried about it, if not more. Our mind is constantly out in the cold if it doesn't have anywhere to get back to be at peace and happy. Here we have made the possibility of having a home for the mind where it can get back to. It is totally independent of outer conditions, whether it snows or storms, whether the world is going crazy as it usually does, it doesn't matter. We have found an inner haven which is independent of others. And having found that inner haven, we are, of course, also a support for other people, because those people who have inner peace and happiness are rare enough in the world. And others that are, most people are, pushed around by the storm and the waves of living, are constantly looking for a solid rock somewhere. So having become one, others also have a support system without going out and being trying to convert people to anything. So the although the states of mind that one has during the meditation will not remain the same, there is a change in consciousness. And that change in consciousness brings one to the possibility of seeing the world and oneself in a different light. It is no longer me and mine all the time. It is no longer you and I or them and us. And it is no longer that constant duality system of good and bad, of future and past, of having and not having, of wanting and not wanting, becoming and not becoming. It has become more of a universal unity in which everything arises and ceases. And seeing things in that way, even though nothing has changed out there, it all looks exactly the same as before, it has changed inside. And so it doesn't have the same impact anymore. It doesn't touch so much anymore. There's no other way of doing it except through meditation. And the best way is to do it